Morning. You need to read the question live. Stop making the same room.
Thank you. solemnly sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Good morning, Mr. Tribilco.
Good morning.
Please confirm your full name is Erwin Mark Tribilco.
Yes.
And you've prepared three statements of evidence in these proceedings dated 26 May, 22 June, and 25 August 2023.
That's right.
And your qualifications and experience are set out on the first of those.
That's right.
And I understand you have one correction you wanted to make, which was provided to the court earlier this week. And it was about deleting the definition of nitrogen leaching loss rate from the glossary and provisions.
That's right.
Do you have any other corrections to make to your evidence?
No, sir.
Thank you. So you, do you confirm it is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
And you participated in two lots of expert conferencing, or the conferencing that led to two joint witness statements, one on point source discharges and the other on everything else. Now, I understand in light of sitting in the back of the court for the week so far, there were some matters of explanation you thought it might be helpful for you to provide on some key aspects of the provisions to enable parties to understand and the court to understand the way certain components work from your perspective. Would you be able to take us through that now with reference, I understand, to the post-conferencing version of the provisions?
Certainly. So, there's been, all of the conversation we have, it seems to me that there are varying kinds of understandings of different provisions. So I would like to just kind of take you very quickly through some things that I think are important to understand where PC1 has come from, where it's got to now. So I'll do that as quickly as I can.
Well, you take your time, partly to let the people transcribing your evidence get an accurate transcription, and partly so that those of us who still are in the habit of taking notes can get a reasonable note, so that when we go back and read the transcript, we can follow that along in terms of what you've said.
Certainly.
You take your time.
Thank you. So I'd like to start with the objectives and just really quickly point out that so we have five objectives. There's no hierarchy of objectives. There is some tension between some of the objectives, and that plays out through consent processes and so on. So it's just important to understand that from the beginning. Objective one, the 80-year objective. Objective two, the short-term 10-year objective. And I would like to point out the kind of wording in those objectives one and two is very important because it talks in terms similar to Te Tiri Whai Mana, reflecting the expectations of Te Tiri Whai Mana in terms of management of water. So it's talking about restoration and protection. So the point I want to make is that those objectives aren't just about chemistry and targets. It's a much kind of broader way, and the vision and strategy, the way it talks about what it's trying to achieve, we can't just pin it down to chemistry. And I just wanted to make that point. So then objective three about well-beings, objective four, tangata whenua values, and objective five about the whai merino recognising its outstanding nature. So that's all I wanted to say, sir, about the objectives. Just again, just a couple of key points about the policies in order to sort of help the understanding. And I must admit, I didn't go right through this process, and I must point that out. I came really heavily into the process of PC1 at the point of appeals. I did attend a little bit of the hearings, but I wasn't there all the time. And before that, the earlier processes, so there's probably gaps in my knowledge in the earlier processes. So I was at a time, like everybody here, having a look at these things and trying to understand what they mean without some of the history of their development. So that they are quite complex. Just wanted to say policy one is really important because it's just the overall big picture of what are we trying to do in terms of farm management, and that's what its job is. Policy two, even though it talks about farming, it's really about pastoral farming, and commercial vegetable production is really dealt with in a different policy. So when we're looking at policy two, we're really looking at the pastoral farming and the cropping to some degree as well. The way this has been rearranged, and this has had a lot of changes through discussions, long discussions in mediations. We've all collectively tried to agree on things to address some of the concerns that people wrote. So it's had a lot of changes, and in my view has been significantly improved through that process. But I want to point out that policy 2, capital A, is really about rule 3.11.4.1, the sort of the first committed activity rule for small farms and very low intensity farms. Policy 2BA is really about rule 3.11.4.3. So that's the other main committed activity rule for farming. Policy 2B is about moderate risk farming. That's really about rule 3.11.4.4. There may be edges where it's not quite there, but that's roughly the way I see this and try and conceptualise it. Policy 2, capital B, C, is really about rule 3.11.4.7a, which is a new rule that I've proposed for high risk dairy farming, and I'll talk a bit more about that a bit later. I want to point out that policy 2E is really important. It's the only kind of policy direction for land use change. So it's kind of looks small, but it's dealing with a big issue. And it's important from that point of view. The remainder of the clauses in policy 2 are really about stock exclusion. And so they set up the outcomes to be achieved. What's the policy direction if we can't exclude all cattle from rivers? How does that deal with that? And finally, it talks a bit about riparian buffers, which aren't a requirement in the sense of planting out buffers. They're not a requirement, but it encourages them. So that's the important things that I see in policy two. Policy three is about commercial vegetable production. Now, all of the provisions relating to commercial vegetable production have had significant changes through the process. A number of reasons for that. I think there were some initial problems with the recommended version from the hearing panel, but just there was also a lot of conversation about how can we align the CDP provisions with the expectations for other farming, and there was a lot of kind of movement to try and to get better alignment along those lines. So I won't go any further into that, but yes, there's quite a lot going on in policy 3 for CDP, commercial vegetable production. Policy 4 is about farm environment plans. I don't think I need to say any more about that at this stage. Policy 5 is about offsetting and compensation. Now, this is really about offsetting and compensation in relation to diffuse discharges, in relation to farming, particularly land use change, as opposed to offsetting and compensation for point source discharges, which is really kind of a separate kind of way of looking at it. And for point source discharges, offsetting and compensation is dealt with in policy 12. So policy 5 really needs to be looked at in terms of diffuse discharges. I won't talk about all the rest of the policies. Policy 7, consent term, we've had lots of discussion about that already, and there'll be more to come. It's quite controversial. I'll just take you down to policies 11, 12, 13, 14, point source discharge policies. And then policies 15, 16, 17 are the ones relating to wetlands and lakes and the fauna marino. Then the very important policy 18 about, again, tangata whenua values, sort of to assist the policy to the objective 4. And then policy 19. Policy 19, just kind of pointing out, it's kind of an old personnel type policy. It's recognising that Tiriwha Mana has a range of objectives and outcomes it's seeking to achieve, not just water quality matters. And so it's just pointing out other things that could be encouraged or opportunities taken when we're dealing with water quality issues and consents and so on for that. So that's all I'd like to say about the policies. I hope that's sort of helpful. Section 11.3, implementation methods. I won't talk about those. Just the headings themselves. I'm quite clear about what each one of those is about. I'm happy to answer any questions later, but we'll just carry on, I think. Then we get to the rules in section 3.11.4. And I want to point out that the notes that I proposed at the beginning of 3.11.4, they were very important. So there were a lot of discussions about two things, and it's trying to address kind of two things. One is, what do you do when you've got a farm that has a mixture of dry stock, dairy, and other kinds of farming going on? How do the rules apply in that kind of situation? And so that's trying to help there. But the second thing that is important to me anyway, there's a lot of discussion about when you're consenting a farm, what is a farm? So how big an area, how many different properties would that consent relate to? And it kind of relates also to farm environment plans. Is that kind of, when you have a farm environment plan, what area should that cover? And I must say that the farm environment plan regulations are not that helpful in that respect. They just talk about a farm environment plan for the farm, as far as I remember it. So there's been a lot of debate. The hearing panel said that the property really is the best unit of area for the purposes of regulation for farming. The individual property, and it's defined in the glossary. We had a lot of discussion around that, and there's nowhere near a resolution on it, but there was a lot of discussion about the fact that there's a lot of farmers that farm kind of a single operating unit, but it's on more than one property. So you might have your home farm, and you might have a couple of other blocks nearby that are integral to that farming operation, that home farm operation, in the sense that some cattle may be wintered off on some other blocks, or there may be a cropping block somewhere else, but it all is part of a kind of a farming operation, if you like. So through the process, I've proposed that consents and farm plans can relate to individual properties, or they could relate to a single operating unit in that sense. And I've defined single operating unit as clearly as I can, because again, there's lots of discussion about what does that really mean. So that's where these kind of notes are trying to come from. So the first one, farm environment plan can be for a single property or a single operating unit. Second one, consent. Addresses this issue of, if you've got different kinds of farming on a particular farm, what activity status do you use? Well, you use the activity status that relates to the highest risk farming activity. And then the third one, also really important, you know already that the rules have thresholds based on winter stocking rate, cattle winter stocking rate, and you need to identify dairy stocking rate for the use of the nitrogen risk scorecard. So all those, how do you work out what the stocking rate is? What's the area of land that applies to when you've got different activities on the same farm and sometimes overlapping areas? The only way I can think of to make that clear is to say there has to be an apportionment of the farm to show how much land is used for dairy, say the mixed dairy and dry stock, how much is used for dry stock, how much is used for dairy. It doesn't mean to say you have to identify the paddocks that you use for each one, but you have to apportion a certain area for each of those two farm systems. It's the best I can do in terms of trying to help with that situation. So then we come to policy 3.11.4.1. It's the first permitted activity rule for small farms under 20 hectares, effectively, or farms over 20 hectares that are mostly equine, horse properties, or free-range poultry. And then we have some fairly restrictive conditions on there, no dairying, no commercial beef in production, limits on cropping and so on. Rule 3.11.4.2, it's an interim permitted activity rule, so that's to authorise or permit farming that will need a consent, but the consent isn't needed until a certain date. So that's what that's about. And then we come to Rule 3.11.4.3. To me, 3.11.4.3 and 3.11.4.4 are the big deals in terms of rules for pastoral farming. Most farming would be authorised by one of those two rules. So 3.11.4.3 is the permitted activity rule, and you will see the thresholds in there. So that's for dry stock farming less than or equal 70 stock units, and the cattle stocking rate is less than 30. And for dairy, it's less than 123 as a nitrogen risk scorecard number, or 111 in the upper Waikato. So those are the two thresholds for dairy and dry stock. Or we have 3B, which says if you're a farm and you meet all of the conditions of permitted activity rule 3.11.4.1, except for conditions 4 and 5, and that's the condition about the amount of cropping, more than 5%, arable cropping, and I think sacrifice paddocks is the other one. So if you meet all those conditions apart from those two, then you can be permitted by this rule subject to the other conditions. I just want to point out, so in this rule, a farm environment plan is required in condition 6. There's no explicit requirement under the rule for that farm environment plan to be certified, but condition 6D says we're required to be certified by Part 9A of the Resource Management Act and the Freshwater Farm Regulations. Needs to be certified by certain dates. So the rule itself doesn't require certification, it just recognises that most farms under this rule will need to be certified under the Freshwater Farm Plan Regulations and Part 9A. I think that's all I want to say about that rule. And then 3.11.4.4, controlled activity rule. Most dairy farming probably will fit into that rule. And again, we have the thresholds for the rule. So for dry stock farming, winter stocking rate is greater than 17, or the cattle winter stocking rate is greater than 13. So there's no maximum there. In other words, any dry stock farming that's over those numbers fits into this rule. It's the highest, provided you can meet the other conditions, it is the highest kind of activity status rule for dry stock farming. And then for dairy, it covers where the nitrogen risk scorecard value is greater than 123 or greater than 111 in the upper Waikato and less than 233. So there is an upper limit in this rule. And so we need another rule for the higher risk dairy farming. Arable cropping that doesn't satisfy other rules is also controlled activity under this rule. And then there's a 4B. And 4B, it looks complex. It's simply saying if you meet the thresholds for Rule 3.11.4.3 or permitted activity rule 3.11.4.3, but you can't meet clauses 1 to 4 of Schedule C, those are the stock exclusion provisions, or one more of the standards in Schedule D1, then you can be a controlled activity under this rule. So those are the two sort of ways of getting into this rule. And simply just want to point out again, this does require a farm environment plan, but this one's different in the sense that the farm environment plan is required by this rule to be certified, and certified that certain things happen or are satisfied. And I think that's all I want to say about that rule. 3.11.4.5. So this is the rule for existing commercial vegetable production. What is existing commercial vegetable production? Now, that's really important. And it's defined in Clause 2 of that rule, Condition 2. And it's basically saying, existing commercial vegetable production is that land that an operator has used. The operator works out between the years 2006 and 2016, which was the year that they used the most land for commercial vegetable production. And then, in that year, under 2B, how much land was used in each subcatchment? And that's the definition, if you like, of existing commercial vegetable production. So if you're going beyond that, then you go to another rule. This rule used to have an area cap and a nitrogen cap. It now only has an area cap, because the nitrogen cap related to overseer, and for a whole lot of reasons, whether or not we kept overseer use in this, really doesn't work well for commercial vegetable production for a whole lot of reasons. I can explain more later if you like. So now it's only an area cap, but it kind of means that area cap is really important. So it's the only way we can define what is existing commercial vegetable production. So I think that's all I want to say about that rule. Then we come to 3.11.4.6. This is also a bit tricky, but anyway, it's a restricted discretionary activity rule for farming in the Fong and Merino wetland catchment. And that's recognising the outstanding nature of the Fong and Merino wetland complex, understanding the sensitivity of that catchment and of the wetland, and of the issues, problems in terms of water quality in that catchment. So it's given special status, it's given a special role. That rule is mostly about pastoral farming, but also is about commercial vegetable production. Now, this gets tricky. So we've got a special rule for existing commercial vegetable production, a rule for expansion, but that controlled activity rule for existing CVP kind of becomes a restricted discretionary rule for CVP in the Fong and Merino. So it's just raised up a level in terms of the analysis that needs to be done to recognise the outstanding nature. And I think that's all I want to say again. That has to be certified. Farm plan needs to be certified under the rule. And it does cross-reference into 3.11.4.5 in Condition 9 of that rule. Does bring in some of the conditions of the rule for existing commercial production. Then we move to a rule 3.11.4.7a, which is the new proposed rule for restricted discretionary activity status for high-risk farming. And this was a rule after a lot of the appeals and the discussions through mediation that I proposed. It would have been a full discretionary activity rule for high-risk farming under Rule 3.11.4.7, but now we've turned it into a restricted discretionary activity rule. I've explained the reasons for that in paragraph 356 of my evidence in chief, But it's mostly because this is for existing high risk or high intensity dairy farming. It's pretty much a predictable situation. We all know well in terms of the issues and potential effects, and so it's possible to list, in my view anyway, matters of discretion for the rule. So providing it's a fairly defined rule, and it is at the moment as I proposed it, then I think it can be respected discretion at all, which is why I proposed that. Then we move to Rule 3147. This is the default rule if you don't fit into any other rule. Again, we've made a number of changes to that, which we can talk about. But just the one thing I want to point out, it is a default rule with conditions, and there's been some requests for the conditions to be deleted from that rule, and we no doubt will have discussions around that as well. But at the moment, it is a default rule with conditions, so theoretically, some activities may not meet those conditions, in which case they become innominate under the Act. And then we move to Rule 3148. This is the discretionary activity rule for expansion of commercial reefing production. And I don't want to go into this too much, but you'll see with all the colours on the page, a lot of changes have been made to this rule, and we'll no doubt have more conversation about that one as we go. And finally, Rule 3149 is the non-compliant activity rule. It's a different rule to the other ones. It's only a land use rule. It's not a land use and discharge rule. All the others are land use and discharge rules. The reason it's not a discharge rule is that it's just a rule to authorise a land use of any change of land to commercial vegetable production or a change of more than 4.1 hectares from woody vegetation to farming, or any land use to dairy farm. It's only a rule to authorise the change in land use. The ongoing discharges and the ongoing land use, in the way I interpret this, need to be authorised by one of the other rules. So once you've changed your land use, the ongoing discharge in land use may be permitted by one of the mandatory rules, or may need another consent under one of the controlled or discretionary or restricted discretionary rules. Again, that's kind of a difficult one, and there were a couple of questions earlier this week around what is it that this rule is actually seeking to authorise. It's just the land use change. And that's really about all I want to say. Just quickly flicking through the schedules. Schedule A is about registration. Schedule B is just a schedule in my proposed version to describe how to determine the nitrogen risk scorecard number for a dairy farm. Schedule C is well aware, mostly about it's the minimum farming standards, stock exclusion, which I don't think I want to get into right now, but a lot to unpack in there, and I do want to spend some time talking about how I think this works, but not right now, because I think there's quite a lot of misconception about how this works. So anyway, we won't do that now. Then Schedule D1 is requirements for farm environment plans for permitted activity farming under Rule 3143. Schedule D2, requirements for farm environment plans for consented farms. And I think that's all I want to say. We can have tackle some other things later on in the notes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kabrilko. I thought I'd pause before I open up to cross examination to see if there are any questions or clarification at this point.
No, I think that's fine, thank you. Obviously,
Well, we'll see how the question and answer goes and whether or not, in fact, there is going to be a need for further explanation. But the starting point will be that parties are entitled to test the evidence.
Thank you, Your Honour. Thank you, Mr. Tribulco. Would you please remain answering the question?
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Tribulco. Just in your evidence in chief there, you were going through the plan. Thank you for that. But you left Schedule C, the stop exclusions. You wanted to leave that for later. You wanted to unpack that. I might invite you to do that now, if you may, if you could, simply because I may have some questions that may not fit entirely with the way in which you unpack Schedule C.
Thank you very much. First point I want to make is that Schedule C is about stock exclusion. It's not about fencing as such, although fencing, of course, is one of the ways that stock can be excluded. It used to be a pretty simple provision that said, if you're under 15 degrees, you need fence. If you're over 15 degrees, you need to exclude stock. And if you can't do that, then you flick into another rule. You couldn't be a permitted activity rule. You'd have to at least flick into Rule 3744. We've had huge amounts of discussion, more than any other part of Plan Change 1, this has been debated. And we keep trying to respond to the concerns raised. And of course the big one is the cost of fencing and the difficulty of fencing. And because of that, we've changed the provision quite significantly. So just really quickly, what does it say? And so it says that water bodies need to be fenced with a temporary permanent or virtual fence to exclude those listed cattle unless those animals are prevented from entering the bed by a stock-proof natural or constructive barrier formed by topographic vegetation. And then A, so that needs to be the case for at the moment for any land up to 10 degrees. And then B, for land over 10 degrees, where any paddock, and that's another important point, adjoining the water body is used for the points 1 or 2. So we're not talking about the whole farm here, we're just talking about paddocks that have one of the noted water bodies in them. And then, so if it's used for intensive winter intensive grazing, then it needs to be fenced if it's for the over 10 degrees. And then we get into B2. So first bit, where number of stock units exceed 18 per grazed hectare at any time. I just want to concentrate on that bit for now. What I was trying to do in my thinking about this was to keep it pretty simple for extensive farming to provide a way where it was clear where fencing itself wasn't required. So, you know, if you're not intensive grazing and you've got steep land, then in any paddock where that stocking rate is exceeded, you need to fence. But if it's not exceeded, if that stocking rate is not exceeded, you don't need to fence. Just leaving it at that for now. So the principle was, if you've got steep land and you've got some cattle in there, that's okay if there is some cattle access to water bodies. Now, the sum is very small. 18 stock units is not very many. That's two or three animals, cattle, per hectare. I don't know if that's the right number. As a matter of fact, my gut feeling is it's not. And I've spent 3 years talking to all sorts of people about what that number should be. And, of course, nobody's got hard evidence to say what that number should be. And that's a problem, in my view, because I still think it's good to have a number in there for these sort of situations so that farmers know they're going to have, they've got a paddock and there's a stream going through that paddock and there's no fence in that paddock to protect the stream. How many cattle can they put in there without having any other requirements of them? So that's what it is. When I think about this, I think of a paddock, I think of a stream going through it, and I think to myself, if there's a couple of cattle in there, they're probably not going to have a huge effect on that stream. They wander around, you know, most of the time they're feeding, and even if they do get in the stream or wander on the banks, it's probably not going to make a huge mess of things, a couple of cattle. But if you put 100 cattle in that paddock, it's going to create a mess, just as. So what's the right number? And I keep thinking, what is the right number? After all the people I've talked to be honest, and I was asked to pick a number out of the air, I would say it's about 50 stock units per hectare. Have I got any basis for it? No. It's just that I've talked to a lot of people about this. And that's kind of number that it seems to settle on. But, you know, I've got no basis for saying that. Just seemed intuitively right with all the conversations I've had. So I still think it would be really good if we had a number in there, a reasonable number in there, that said, if you're over 15 degrees and you've got a water body, you can have a few cattle in there, let's say 50 stock units per hectare or whatever, you know, if the farm systems guys could come up with something better, that's fine as well. I think 18 is probably too low. Full stop, so that's nice and easy. And when I say that, I don't mean the whole farm has to be set stock. And we've heard about this a lot. I'm just saying, in that paddock, unless you're doing other things, if you've got unfenced waterways, then and you've got more than those the animal numbers, you need to do something more. If you don't, if it's less than those animal numbers, it's okay. For now, we'll get by with that. Not going to do too much damage. That's what we're trying to do. And then we go on to the next bit of Schedule B1, Schedule C1B2. What happens if you go above that number? Well, this has set up a provision that allows for a farm environment plan to certify that even though you're not going to fence it, you're going to do other things to achieve these outcomes in the three bullet points there, prevent or minimise direct deposition of urine, feces and so on. And I've heard the comments that, well, they're pretty vague, aren't they? So that's not very helpful. Let me just say where it comes from. Those three bullet points are directly from the Section 32 report describing, for the initial notified version of PC1, describing what it was that they were trying to achieve from the stock exclusion. They said, these are the three things we're trying to achieve from our stock exclusion vision. So that was right back when we were developing PC1. At one point, I proposed that those three be put into Policy 2, and so we've done that. So they're a policy direction. And at one point, there were various parties suggesting that probably we should put it into the Schedule C as well. I've heard a lot of conversation, and I've been out to Rionberry's farm, which, by the way, was a really useful trip that some of its planners went out to see. It was very, very helpful just to kind of see the difficulties, because that's an extreme end of a difficult farm when it comes to stock exclusion, so it was very useful to go and do that. All through the conversations over the last few years I've had with people, I've heard that Fencing isn't the only answer, that there are other ways that you can exclude stock, or you can at least minimise enough to achieve these sorts of narrative targets, if you like. And we heard again, I think, from Mr. Pennell over the last couple of days, when he was talking about, well, if he's, you know, he's had a paddock and he knows he wants to fence it because there's a stream there, can't do it right now. What's he doing in the interim? And he said, well, I'll make sure that the cattle only go in there for a short term and they eat the best grass and then he'll move them on. And he's saying, if you do that, then stock generally aren't going to go into the waterways. So that's one way. And we've heard lots of other ways. Mr. Brockstock has suggested a number of ways that can be done and so on. I've heard this over and over again from the farmers, that there are ways to effectively keep stock out of the waterway. Most of the time, in order to achieve those outcomes. Now, I don't have any expertise to say they're wrong, so I'm assuming that you can have a situation where you've got more than whatever the number is of stock in paddocks with unfenced waterways, and so you have a certified farm plan that really clearly states what the farmer's going to do to try and meet these three outcomes. I don't mind the fact that those outcome statements are quite vague. I think what it does in this case, it sets up the situation where a farmer has got to have those kinds of conversations with a farm certifier that Mr. Brockstock was talking about, and he was saying how important those conversations are. We are moving from a situation where most of the time those conversations don't happen at all, because we're moving from a situation where we've had almost no regulation of this kind of farming and these kinds of problems, to a situation where there's some quite clear requirements and there is a clear process for a conversation with a certifier about how you can achieve these outcomes. First time you've done this in the Waikato at that kind of level and intensity. I think it's a really good way of getting this whole thing moving, of getting people starting to do the right thing, which I think, in my view, again, quoting Mr. Brockstock, there's a lot of potential for improvements in farming out there, and I think there is too. I wander around farms, which I tend to do quite a bit out where I live. So I think this kind of Schedule C provision, it's not perfect in a kind of a regulatory sense. It might be hard to go up to a farm and sort of say, are you achieving those things or not? But it's a really good way of starting this journey to going to where we need to go, which eventually should be keeping all animals out of all water bodies. It's probably not quite there yet, in my view. So that's the way I'm conceptualising Schedule C. It's the way I continue to support what we've arrived at the moment. And I realise it's open to criticism, it's not perfect, but I think from my point of view, it's the best we can do right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chabilko, for unpacking that. I've just got a couple of questions arising from what you've just said. You mentioned that there's been nothing in place in terms of stock exclusions in particular up until now. Well,
yes,
hopefully.
Very little.
Yes. And so, but this is a plan that's been in the making for 10 years, right?
Yes.
So it's not a surprise, is it, that these stock exclusions are being sought?
No.
So there has been time for those who have been impacted by it to become familiar with it and the importance of it.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Can I add, though, that I know, again, conversations with people out there, yes, people know this is coming. And through PC1 and through all sorts of work that Fonterra and Vietnam and others are doing, everyone knows this is coming, yes. We still don't have an operative plan, and some people are not doing a heck of a lot until they know what the actual requirements are. But you're quite right, there should be a clear expectation that this is coming.
Yes. you know, I think I've picked up from one of the earlier council experts, Mr. Sinclair, that there's a focus on educating as opposed to going to the extent of enforcement. And so, just getting back to the units, you mentioned that there was no basis, evidential basis for that number. You kind of plucked it out of the sky.
That's right.
Gut feeling.
Yes.
Yep. But then you went on to say that there shouldn't be much damage as a result of those numbers.
I'm just talking intuitively from wandering around paddocks quite a lot and growing off an on-farm myself.
Right. Okay, so I might come back to setbacks, and I'll start off with my questions. I just wanted to pick up on a few things that you mentioned in your evidence in chief and around the Schedule C. So, if I could turn your mind to Objective 5, which is the Objective 5 that seeks to restore and protect the whanga mare nor wetland. And in your rebuttal, which is, do you have a copy in front of you?
Yes, I
have. Tab 18 of 301. And at policy 5, you start discussing that at page 50. Sorry, not policy 5, objective 5. And in there, you make mention of Ms. Ma, the planning expert for Fish and Game. In relation to objective 5, she is supporting an amendment to objective 5. So,
objective 5 or policy 5?
My objective 5, sir. And that's on page 18, sir.
18.
Sorry.
So you're talking about paragraph 50.
Paragraph 46 in your rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
And so the policy reads, restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the whanga mare nor wetland over time and in relation to the four contaminants, and the wording that Ms. Ma is proposing is including the hydrological drivers of the transport and deposition of those contaminants at least by 2096, and consistent with its status as an outstanding water body with significant values. So, and your evidence is that you don't support the amendment.
That's right.
And you go on to talk about that there's no, it's not appropriate to have an objective where there hasn't been the section 32.
That's right. Can I just add that it's not appropriate in my view to have an objective that doesn't have provisions to support its achievement.
And so you no doubt have read the water quality joint witness statement?
I have.
And so that's at tab 3 in the 400 series. You will read note in there question 4 and 5. No, sorry, my mistake, it's the wetlands. JWS, which is tab 3.
That's the day 2.
Is that right?
Tab 3 or tab 2?
Tab 3, I believe.
So that's day 1, I think. And which question?
Question 4 and 5. And so in there, you will see that question 4, seeing we've got the right one there, agrees that that without significant intervention going on, ongoing deterioration of the whanga mare nor ecosystem health is unavoidable. Do both contaminants and hydrological drivers need to be addressed? And the answer there is yes. It talks about we need significant intervention to halt the decline, given the recent events especially. And then it goes on to support the need for hydrological drivers that are inherently associated with the management of water quality contaminants, the volume of water coming from different water sources, and its associated contaminant loads has an impact on achieving the targets in PC1 attribute states for the wetlands. So in light of that evidence and that agreement at the joint in the joint witness statement, do you continue to hold your view that it's not appropriate to use hydrological drivers referenced in the objective 5?
Yes, I do. This is the difference, I think, between science and a policy position. So yes, that's a science position, and I fully accept it, and I accept Mr. Scarsbrook's evidence on that as well, that yes, dealing with, we're not going to fix the problems there until we deal with the hydrological drivers, certainly accept that. But from a policy point of view, adding something to an objective without adding anything to achieve it, or possibly even worse, that giving an expectation that farmers and others out there are going to do some different things to achieve that objective without an assessment about what do they have to do to achieve it, what's it going to cost, and so on. So from a policy perspective, I don't think it's a good idea to add an additional requirement in terms of something we're trying to achieve without a Section 32 analysis that says these are the most appropriate, efficient, effective ways to achieve that objective. There's been no assessment on that through PC1, so it's just a policy position.
Although Policy 16 has reference to hydrological drivers.
Yes, it does.
Can you explain why it's appropriate there but not here?
It's probably written a little bit confusingly. I read Policy 16 as saying that we need to reduce diffuse discharges of contaminants to assist with these things, while taking into account the hydrological drivers. Now, I read that as meaning that we need to do these things to reduce those contaminants, but we need to take into account that we're not actually going to do make a big benefit to it because of the hydrological drivers. That's the way I read that. I don't read that as saying we need to manage the hydrological drivers in PC1. I don't read it that way. And I think from memory, and I can't remember the words, but I think that's the kind of rhetoric in the recommendation report from the hearing panel. They were recognising hydrological drivers are really important, but this plan change is not it's not managing them. That's how I interpret that policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chibilko. If we could move on to Policy 16 then. And so, Policy 16 is about protecting or reducing contaminants. And that's in the Whangamarenu wetland. And if I could turn you back to the wetlands JWS, and there it talks about FMUs, particularly question 7 and 8 in the wetlands JWS. And I suppose you've read the wetlands JWS previously?
Yes.
And so you'll note that the experts there agreed that there would be benefit in making the wetland, the Whangamarenu wetland, its own FMU, and that there is sufficient technical information to support a Whangamarenu FMU. And, you know, from a technical perspective, as I've just said, that's supported. Do you continue to hold the view, as in your rebuttal evidence, that it's not appropriate?
Yes, I do, again, for the reasons that I stated in paragraph 50 of my rebuttal evidence. Would you like me to read that out? Or
you don't need to read it out.
Yeah, thank you very much. So there's a variety of reasons, but just generally speaking, my view is that an FMU under the NPSFM is a tool for starting off the NOF process. That's what it's for. Is it? An FMU is the establishment of a practical, reasonable management unit in terms of an area in order to go through the process in full consultation with the community about what are the values of that FMU, what outcomes, what objectives should it have, what target attribute state should it have. So it's the beginning part of a process. My view and my understanding from reading the NPS is that an FMU does not bestow a particular status on an area or a water body such that it would be managed differently or thought of differently if it was an FMU compared to what if it wasn't. I just don't see it that way. If you did establish the Fine Marina Wetland as an FMU, and I don't have a problem with that as a concept, it's just that the way of doing it to me is wrong. It should be established through the Freshwater Policy Review that says, okay, let's make this an FMU, let's have the conversations with the community about what the outcome should be and how to get there and all of that. Just changing its status in PC1 on its own, in my view, doesn't do anything. And I hear what the experts are saying, the scientific experts, but again, from a policy point of view, I don't think that bestows anything at all. And I mean, I've listened to Mike Scar's book as well, saying, well, if it was an FMU, we might be able to argue more easily for funds to do something about the Fine Marina. He may be right. I still don't see it as the way an FMU should be used. It's not the purpose of an FMU. I don't think we should just stick this thing on the end of it without going through the proper process that the NPS sets up for us.
Thank you, Mr. Jabilko. I guess I should point out that the Director General's wetland expert, Dr. Robertson, also held a similar view. I won't take you to the evidence, but in summary, his view was that there wasn't much more to be gained with an FMU for the Whangamaringa wetland because of everything that's already in the plan. However, his view has changed since then because of these events that have occurred. And so I just guess I want to confirm that even in light of these Blackwater events that Dr. Scar's book has spoken to and the evidence that's been covered, your view is still the same that you've just explained around FMU.
Those events mean that they raise the profile of the issue, they make it really clear we've got to do something about it, but it's not in itself, for me, from a policy point of view, a good reason to change PC1 to turn the Fine Marina into an FMU. That's kind of the way I see it. It's taking nothing away from the problem that needs to be fixed, which, as Mr. Scar's book says, is so big it needs a plan change all of its own to address.
Thank you, Mr. Jabilko. If we can then look at policy 17, which deals with restoration and protection of wetlands other than the Whangamaringa wetland. And so I really want to just ask about the wording in policy 17. So we do need to go to the planning JWS. Tab 401, sorry. And so again, I'm just wanting to understand your reasoning around the amendments that Ms. Ma has suggested in there. So.
Trying to find my version just a moment.
Well, I'll leave it there, but I'll just. Ms. Ma has suggested that in policy 17 there should be some reference to table 311D, noting that the D is incorrect, it should have been an E, and I traversed that in the planning JWS. And as I understand from your rebuttal, you were agreeable to that reference being included in policy 17, the reference to so that target attribute states in table 311D are met. But then through the planning JWS, there was agreement to remove that wording because of the reference to D instead of E. Do you follow where I'm coming from?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And then in Ms. Ma's rebuttal evidence, she suggests a new 311.1E table that covers the wetlands narratives that Dr. Robertson has proposed.
Yes.
But there doesn't seem to be any rationale for why that's not come through into the post-conferencing version of PC1. Are you able to explain?
Well, my understanding is that Mr. Scarsbrook doesn't accept the inclusion of that table 311.1E, and I take my guidance from him. It's a science issue, and if the table's not included in PC1, then it doesn't need to be referenced in the policy.
It's a science issue, did you say?
The inclusion of the table is a science issue, and Mr. Scarsbrook doesn't agree that that table should be added.
Yet in previous policies we've discussed, you've not so much relied on the science, you've relied on the policy. You tend to be shifting there.
I will rely on science for science matters. And in this case, whether Table 311.1E is included is a science question in my mind. Because it sets up targets from a science point of view. And if Mr. Scarsbrook thinks that should be in there, then I'd say, yes, let's put it in there and let's refer it to it in the policy. But Mr. Scarsbrook doesn't support that table, and so I don't support it being referenced in the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Tribilco. Can we just turn then to the implementation methods, 311.3.1 in particular, and PC1 and the post-conferencing version. And if I could ask you to also turn to Ms. Keswick's version attached to her evidence.
Sorry, which version is that?
Ms. Keswick.
Can you give me some numbers for
yes,
that?
Sorry, I'll just find my video. So it's page 320192, and that's in tab 4320089.
What number on the number file?
If you're on volume 320, is one of the I think it's under tab 4. What was the page reference again? 320.0192?
That's right, sir.
Thank you.
So I guess where I'm coming from with this question, Mr. Tribilco, is I would like you to have the post-conferencing version alongside Ms. Keswick's version of 311.1. And the wetlands JWS basically confirms that, and we could go if we need to, but it confirms that there needs to be a robust implementation method to ensure the best available information is there and future to inform future planning processes.
Yes.
Yep. You accept that?
Yes.
And so when we look at the version that you support of 3.11.1, there, alongside Ms. Keswick's version, we might need to just go through that. There is far more detail in Ms. Keswick's proposed version. You'd have to accept that.
Yes.
And it's a version. It's consistent with where the experts have landed in the joint witness statement in terms of what I've just said, having the best available information, so ensuring there are methods in Plan Change 1 now to help inform those decisions going forward into next plan changes and to the freshwater policy review.
Are you saying that the experts agreed to this wording?
No, I'm not saying
right.
that. What I'm
Thank
saying
you.
Is
no,
that
I understand what
they,
saying.
They consider a robust monitoring
yes.
should be included in the implementation
sure.
methods.
Thank you.
To ensure this information is available to inform next
yes.
future processes. That's what I'm saying.
Sure.
So, surely, just looking at C in Ms. Keswick's version versus the version you have supported, Ms. Keswick adds, including as a priority, the action plan in the Waikare and Whangamaranoa wetland catchment management plan. Those action, that action plan is referred to in the joint witness statement for wetlands
yes.
as a priority in
yes.
terms of managing the issues at the wetland.
Mm.
And so wouldn't it make sense to ensure that these information available going forward, accepting that this is the first step to giving effect to Te Tuhi Whaimana.
Mm.
So we're not going to achieve everything now, I accept that, but surely we should be setting up processes now through implementation methods to ensure that information is available in future. So
sure.
we can make...
I accept that, but can I talk about the specifics of these words here? And this again, this was discussed quite a bit through the mediation processes, and I think these words were suggested back then as well, and I think we had conversations about them, because I remember the debate about should we add reference and requirement that...
Can I just pause you just there? We can't speak to mediation discussions.
Oh, okay.
If we just keep focused
so,
on evidence.
Okay. All I'm saying is that in relation from those mediations, ideas were raised. I went and spoke to the people who developed these plans, and just to see what they thought about it. Could we make a requirement that those plans be implemented as priority? And they said, no, you can't. And the reason is that Lake Waikare and Whangamaranoa wetland catchment management plans were developed with the communities. This is very much a kind of a voluntary process where the landowners in that area worked with the council to come up with a management plan. But it was very, very much expressly stated that it wasn't a mandatory management plan. Those landowners only signed up to it and only were involved in this on the basis that this is what we agree we're trying to do, but it wasn't meant to be a regulatory requirement, and they made that very, very clear. So, and it's written in the plan. It's written in the plan. This is not a requirement. This is what we've kind of agreed to do. I can't remember the wording. I'm sorry. But my conclusion from all of those conversations with the people who developed those plans was that it wouldn't be appropriate to require them to be actioned in the way that they're written in the regional plan. Just wouldn't go there, given the way that those landowners contributed to the process and their understanding of that at the time. So that's that C. That's the reason why I haven't agreed to include that.
So just in response to that, or a further question there, I mean, you mentioned, and I understand it's a voluntary sign up by the landowners in relation to that catchment plan. But again, I have to go back to the environment we're looking at now. the black water event, the botulism, the ongoing degradation. And surely, if we're relying on voluntarily doing things, which clearly aren't being done because we wouldn't have this situation, I would not have thought, surely something more needs to be provided for to ensure actions as those are proposed in the management plan should be included here.
I agree a whole lot more needs to be done. I'm just saying that that management plan shouldn't be specifically mentioned as a requirement here.
Even though it's there voluntarily and it's not being implemented to the extent it should be, you still hold that view?
I don't believe we should break agreements with the people we've made agreements with.
Thank you.
So I can go on and talk about those other clauses if you'd like
yes,
me to.
Please.
Yeah. So clause D. This was setting up, the implementation method was to set up specific, as I understand it, monitoring requirements. As you remember, when Mr. Scarsbrook was questioned, he was saying, we've just been putting in place a wetland monitoring process, still kind of working through what's possible, given the tens of thousands of wetlands, in terms of what should be monitored where and all of that sort of stuff. So the science, or the scientists, weren't at a point where they could say, we will do these things. Just still at the beginning of that process. And so again, I didn't think it was appropriate to include a requirement in the plan that may or may not be practical or even possible right now. We've still got a lot to learn about this whole kind of the wetland systems and how to monitor them. What to monitor where and all that sort of stuff. What's it going to tell us? Where do we want to know information? So it didn't seem appropriate to put that level of detail in as a method right now for those reasons.
You will know Mr. Trebilco, the Director General, has sought in her appeal a number of target attribute states.
Sorry, just repeat.
The Director General has sought in her appeal a number of attribute states,
yes.
Quality attribute states.
Yes.
However, given the lack of information currently available, the Director General is now looking to appropriate and robust implementation methods to ensure that the information that's not available now will be available in future.
Yes, I understand.
So shouldn't these methods be far more robust than what you support to ensure that information is available?
Yes. But, I mean, again, I have to take my lead from the scientists. I don't know what can be done or should be done. And if they're saying they're not in a position to support those additional words, then from a policy point of view, I couldn't support them being added. I understand what you're trying to do. I fully accept that. But in this case, I think it's just going a step too far. We're just not there yet. We're not ready to say, this is what we think should be done right now.
Even though this is a plan 10 years in the making.
Well, I'm not part of the science team. I don't know what their kind of reasons are for what they do at any particular time. Yes, it would have been great if we'd done more monitoring early on in that respect.
Thank you.
Can I move on to the last one then?
Oh, of course.
So this is saying that requiring a review of the Lower Waikato flood control scheme by 2024 to specifically identify opportunities to reduce sediment and nutrients entering the Whangarei wetland. But again, to me, that's not something the regional plan should be determining without a really good analysis about what kind of review, how much is it going to cost, what do we need to stop doing in order to do that, etc., etc. It's just, to me, this is not something a regional plan should be doing, and I couldn't recommend it without knowing what it means to council to do that review right now. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know if it's possible or not.
So is the consent for the flood scheme consent they have regular review periods, don't they, that the council may look to exercise. Is that right?
I don't know about that.
So I do have a copy of the consent.
Yeah, no, I believe.
You're familiar with them?
Yes. No, I'm not familiar with them.
Good. Right, okay. So I guess my point there is that there's opportunity for review, but what you're saying is that the council hasn't looked at that yet?
I don't know if they have or they haven't.
No.
I have no idea.
No.
And I don't know what the cost would be. I don't know what the repercussions might be for budgets and so on. I don't know.
Are you aware that the Department of Conservation is working alongside Regional Council together with stakeholders to look at a review of the scheme, potentially?
No,
You're not aware of any of that?
No.
If I could take you back to policy 2,
sure.
Please. And thank you for your explanation and your evidence in chief on policy 2.
Are we finished with this different step in the folder?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I really just want to step you through policy 2B, G.
Yes.
I just have a few questions with policy 2BG in the post-conferencing version I'm looking at. And it's in relation to Roman numeral 1. It talks about critical source areas, and it refers to identification and management of critical source areas. What do you mean? How are they to be identified in minutes? What is your intention with that particular word and that policy?
Well, this was wording that has come from the recommendation report, so it's not my wording. My understanding of it is, so it's saying where farmed cattle and so on are not excluded from streams, what else can you do? And this is, so they're saying, first thing is, well, let's have a look at critical source areas and try and manage those. And it's exactly what Dr. Scarsbrook again said. What's the first thing we should do? Exclude cattle from water bodies. What's the second thing we should do? Address critical source areas. And I think it's right along those lines.
And do you agree that this policy and policy 4 would only be relevant considerations for those activities that are to seek resource consent?
Yes, that would be right.
So permitted wouldn't be captured?
That's right. I'm pretty sure there are provisions about critical source areas in Schedule D1, which is about farm plans for permitted activities. So.
And you're aware from the joint witness statement for water quality that they agree that ephemeral waterways are significant sources of contaminants?
Ephemeral waterways?
Yes.
I understand that those, all the one streams and those small streams contribute a lot of sediment, yes.
It's because there's high concentration in those headwaters.
I understand it's because of the large area of those small streams, which collectively can contribute a lot of sediment to the downstream.
And so if I could just turn you then to policy 4.
Yes.
And in that policy, it includes requirements to identify land most vulnerable to disused discharges,
yes,
including critical source areas. What criteria does the plan provide to guide assessment of where physical boundaries of the identified critical source areas might be? Is there any criteria to assist users?
No, there is a definition of critical source areas in the glossary, and one of the changes that I've proposed to better align it with better align the PC1 provisions with the national provisions is to change that definition of critical source areas to, I think it's the NES freshwater definition. So that doesn't, it won't tell you where the edges of things are at that thing, but it tries to specify clearly what one is.
Mm. That's quite a contrast to Schedule C, which is quite prescriptive. You'd agree with that?
In what respect?
Well, you're saying it doesn't provide criteria in Policy 4 around how to identify critical source areas, yet there's quite a prescriptive, more prescriptive guidance in Schedule C, although that deals with stock exclusions. I'm just trying to draw an analogy that it's quite prescriptive in Schedule C, but not so much in this policy.
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at there. I mean, prescriptive for what?
Well, there's some guidance in Schedule C in terms of fencing.
Whereas here, we've got no criteria,
for example, to identify these critical source areas.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Yeah.
And just going to Schedule D then. We've got Schedule D1 and Schedule D2. And so in there it sets out a whole raft of goals. But in Schedule D1 Part D4 refers to the fresh EPPs. For permitted activities required to identify actions to minimise sediment loss from critical source areas. That's what Schedule D1 Part D requires.
And so what was the number? 4?
Yeah, paragraph 4, or clause 4 in D1 Part D.
Part D.
Yes.
That
would be the goals.
Retiring drainage channels. Not sure if I'm looking at the right thing.
Page 44, sorry.
Yes.
I guess my question there is, it talks about identifying actions to minimise sediment loss. What do you expect these actions to be?
Okay. So, well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I mean, these would be actions, I guess, that needs to be determined between the farmer and the... we're not talking about two quite now. Actions to minimise sediment loss from critical source areas are undertaken as soon as possible. What would those actions be? I guess they would be things like changing directions of flow, sort of drainage kind of actions is what I would be seeing. So if you've got a raceway, for example, which could be a critical source area that is currently has runoff going into water bodies, can you direct that away through drainage, adding little drains and things in the right place to do that? That's the kind of thing that I'm expecting from that.
And what guidance in the plan is there around identifying these drains?
There's no more guidance at the moment in that. I think you're right, it would be useful to have some guidance. I don't think it needs to be in the plan, but I think it would be helpful for implementation guidance on the kinds of things that people could do to achieve that. But I don't think it's necessary in the plan to do that.
And so wouldn't you consider stock exclusion as part of some mitigation around reducing effects from critical source areas?
Stock exclusion from critical source areas?
Yes, or rather fencing those areas off. Would you not consider that as a mitigation?
It may be appropriate in some cases. I mean, it depends on the cost benefits again.
Thank you. And if I can take you to... go back to setbacks now, in terms of Schedule C.
just wanted to see whether there are any, I know the answer, but I just want you to confirm, I guess, whether there are any measures in Schedule C to manage sediment loss.
Sure, what you're meaning by the question.
I guess just at a broad level, what measures have been proposed to manage the effects of sediment or sediment loss into water bodies?
I don't think there's anything in Schedule C apart from the stock exclusion, and there may be a couple of other things in there, sacrifice paddocks, cultivation, all of those would be Schedule C matters that would help to reduce sediment loss.
But there's nothing specific around sediment loss itself, is there?
There's no specific statement saying in order to achieve sediment reduction you need to do these things. No. But that doesn't mean to say that the provisions in Schedule C won't reduce sediment loss.
And what basis do you make that view on?
Well, from all the conversations we've heard with the farm systems people and the scientists, for example, if you keep stock off the banks and off waterways, then you're going to reduce damage to water banks and therefore reduce the amount of sediment getting into streams. I mean, that's just one example.
So if we go down to Schedule C, paragraph 4.8.
Yes.
It's about sacrifice paddocks.
Yes.
And in there is proposed a 10-metre setback,
yes,
or ungrazed setback. Can you explain why that's appropriate there?
Well, again, that's come through the recommendation report following the hearing, which was months of hearing, in fact, that the hearing panel listen to a lot of evidence, and that's where they arrived at. I can't tell you the basis of it apart from that.
But you'd agree then that based on that same evidence, exclusions and setbacks are currently the best evidence-based method to attempt to manage sediment loss. Would you agree with that on an evidence-based position?
Say that again, sorry.
So on it. Purely on the evidence
that
you've just referred to,
yeah,
relying on the evidence for your other positions with regards to the policies we've gone through, you've relied on the science.
Yeah.
And so with regards to what the Director General is proposing in terms of stock exclusion and setbacks, which is based on evidence, what plans are there to manage sediment loss then, given that the evidence shows that stock exclusions and setbacks is the evidentially based proven method? What is it proposed in terms of sediment loss?
I'm not really understanding your question, I don't think. Are you saying is the 10-metre buffer the right size? Is that what you're asking me?
Well, I raised the 10-metre buffer because it seems to be appropriate there for the sacrifice paddocks, but
yes,
for some of the setbacks that the Director General is proposing from water bodies, it's not. So I'm just trying to understand what your rationale is there. That's where my question is coming from.
Right. I'm just accepting the hearing panel's view on those setbacks there. They've heard a lot more evidence than I have.
Thank you. If I could just take you then to policy 5, which is the offsetting and compensation policy.
Sure.
You'll be pleased to know this is my last question. So I don't expect you to have any more to answer. So policy 5 refers to the compensation and offsetting and compensation. You've made it clear in your evidence in chief that policy 5 was more directed to disuse discharges, farm, land use changes,
whereas policy 13, so 12 and 13 was more for the port source discharges.
Yes.
I guess that the essence of my question on policy 5 is you've made it clear in your evidence that it's the offsetting and compensation referred to in policy 5 isn't the same as what's in the MPSDF in 2020 in terms of a tendency.
Yes, it's a different kind of offsetting for a different purpose, yes.
Right. And so what basis or what evidence or what guidance, practice guidance have you relied on to develop that policy if it's not based on what's in the MPSDFM?
Well, the hearing panel developed that policy. They were in a situation, the hearing panel were in a situation where they knew that they had target attribute states and they have objective 1 and 2 that they're trying to achieve. But they also knew that there was concern by the CVP people, in particular commercial vegetable production, that there does need to be some expansion of CVP in order to guarantee ongoing supply, given the amount of CVP land that's been used up and so on, increasing demand. And they were trying to find a way of achieving objective 1 and 2 while allowing an increasing CVP, which effectively will result in some increase in nitrogen leaching. So that's where their starting point was. And so they decided that the best way to do that would be through some allowance for offsetting and compensation. And that's why Policy 5 was developed, in order to allow that. I'll point out that Policy 5, again, this is not necessarily just about chemistry, but Policy 5 uses, again, the Tūriwhaumana type language and says, it talks about positive benefits to restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the Waikato and Waipa rivers. So that's what they were trying to do. So they were trying to say, well, can we allow some increase in CVP with some potential increase in nitrogen leaching while still supporting overall restoration and protection of the water bodies? That's where they were coming from. So they devised this kind of way of thinking that said, well, ideally, if you're going to increase CVP in a way that has increased nitrogen, ideally you offset that increase somewhere else. You reduce contaminants somewhere else in order to offset it. And then they said, and if you can't do that, then you should compensate for any increase. So there may be a small increase in nitrogen, but that's compensated by a decrease in other contaminants, so that in their view, overall, there is still a movement towards restoration and protection of the Waikato River. So that's what they were trying to do. And I still think it's possible. I agree, we've had questions about how possible is it to compare an increase in certain contaminants with a decrease in others and so on. Yes, it's not easy. I still think it's possible to do it, and at least in a way that gives some sense that we are still moving towards protection and restoration of the river. While there might be a minor increase in this contaminant, we can see there's going to be, and I think it uses the word considerable, is it?
Demonstrable,
thank you. Decrease in others. And so, you know, if you do, for example, add CVP, take a dairy farm, turn it into CVP, there is a slight increase in nitrogen, but quite a decrease in pathogens, for example, and maybe sediment and phosphorus and other things as well. I think in some cases, we could say, yeah, on balance, we're still moving towards restoration and protection. So that's what Policy 5 is all about. difficult, yes, I know. And the wording originally, I must admit, was really hard. And it took me many, many readings of the original wording to understand what it meant, which is why I've recommended some changes to the wording, just to try and clarify that. But that still seems reasonable to me, and you know, a reasonable way of dealing with a difficult situation.
And I accept that that's the decision coming from the panel, and you ran with that.
Yes.
But since that decision, we've had evidence filed for this hearing, and in that evidence, Dr. Hawkery, our sex compensation expert, has provided evidence around what should be taken into account when you're looking at biodiversity offsetting and compensation.
This is not biodiversity offsetting.
This is the best practice available at the moment in terms of guidance.
It's still biodiversity offsetting. That's not what this is about. And this is the problem in my view. They're different things. And no, I don't believe you can use principles for biodiversity offsetting for this very specific offsetting of contaminants in water.
Then shouldn't it then follow that you should be looking at another concept or word? Because it's not compensation or offsetting in accordance with BEF's guidelines, is it?
Well, it is, in my view, in the kind of general meaning of those terms as I understand them. I think they are the right words.
Have you read Dr. Corkery's evidence?
I've skimmed most of that evidence, so I probably have.
Can I take you to the evidence, please? It's in folder 320 at tab 2.
Yes.
And if you go to page 15 of her evidence, it talks about policy 5.
Yes.
Excuse me. She says in paragraph 67, the current approach proposed by Mr. Tribilco to policy 5B does not meet the criteria for offsetting and compensation, and it's in effect the direct trading between different contaminants by allowing for an increase in one of the four contaminants to be compensated for a reduction in contaminants not increasing. There has to be a like-for-like type approach here. When you're looking at offsetting, you have to offset what you're impacting. And what you're proposing is to, if there's a reduction in nitrogen, you're allowing an increase in phosphorus or vice versa. That's not best practice, according to the experts. And so I guess my question to you is that, do you think it's the right term to be used in policy 5, offsetting and compensation, or should you be looking at another term? For example, nutrient trading, which is what Dr. Corkery has said is what you're proposing.
Well, my view would be nutrient trading would be a less accurate description of what they're trying to do. And I mean, again, I've got to point out that it uses the term, it actually doesn't even use compensation as a term in B. It says, it explains as a common English word, so any increase in the diffuse discharge of one of those contaminants is compensated by a reduction in the diffuse discharge of those contaminants not increasing, etc. So to me, it's a definition within the policy. I don't think, in my view, that doesn't create confusion. I think it's really clearly written as to what it means. So we could use another word from compensated by, maybe, but I don't think it needs to. I think it's quite clear.
So just to be clear, your evidence is that what's proposed in policy 5 is offsetting and compensation, yet it doesn't follow best practice.
No, that's not what my evidence is.
What is your evidence?
Well, as I've just explained, I think it's very clear what those terms mean. They are defined in A and B, both offsetting and compensation. Offsetting and compensation are common English words used in all sorts of situations. It's not just biodiversity offsetting and compensation where those words are used. So you may be right. I don't know, but I don't have a problem with the words. It means clear. The meaning is clear to me. What's intended.
Thank you, Mr.
Tribilco.
Thank you, Your Honour. I have no more questions.
We're going to take the lunch and adjournment now, Mr. Trevilco. You've, I think, been present when other witnesses have been caught in a situation where you're under cross-examination, so you just keep your own counsel over the next hour and a quarter, all right?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we'll adjourn until...